You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
The anonymous author of 1 John is on a salvage mission. Writing sometime around the turn of the first century, maybe 100 to 110, he's apparently appealing to a rather large group who has split from their community over the issue of the real humanity of Jesus. As my Kiwi mentor Bill Loder describes it, Jesus' divinity had so captivated these believers that they appear to have played down his humanity and perhaps denied it altogether, except as a kind of cloak for his divinity. The author is trying to ground his listeners in the truly human, emphasizing the centrality of love and relationships with real people. Spirituality is not some disembodied idea, something cut adrift from history, undirtied by administrative and institutional issues, with Jesus having been dissolved into a symbol. As Bill writes, flesh and blood and real human relations are not an encumbrance, but are themselves the theater of the divine. In our passage today, it's clear that some people have become so carried away with the spiritual that they've neglected even the most basic principles of helping a neighbor in need, oblivious to the fact that love has to include consideration of the well-being of others. And the author makes it clear that this Jesus love has nothing to do with vicarious sacrifice and blood atonement, but is grounded in the interest of others. But just like today, there were Christians back then who needed to be reminded that what Jesus was talking about was not some individualized spiritual experience, but a love that engaged with all the complexities, politics, and social turmoil of the real world.
Our words of wisdom are from 1 John chapter 3, verses 16 through 18, the Message version.
This is how we've come to understand and experience love. Christ sacrificed his life for us. This is why we ought to live sacrificially for our fellow believers and not just be out for ourselves.
If you see some brother or sister in need and have the means to do something about it, but turn a cold shoulder and do nothing, what happens to God's love? It disappears, and you made it disappear.
My dear children, let's not just talk about love. Let's practice real love. This is the only way we'll know we're living truly, living in God's reality. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Once upon a time, Career Day was on the schedule for the local parochial school. A nun, teaching her elementary school class, asked the students what they wanted to be when they grew up. Most of the kids who raised their hands offered up the usual. A doctor, a firefighter, an astronaut, until little Susie raised her hand. The nun asked, "Susie, what would you like to be?" And the little girl answered, "A prostitute." Shocked, the nun asked, "What did you say, Susie?" "A prostitute." "Oh, thank God," said the nun. "At first I thought you said Protestant." Look, sad to say, but sometimes our religious biases can warp our sensibilities. Sometimes we get so caught up in thinking that there's just one way to do things and demonizing the things we don't understand that we miss a whole world of possibilities. And one of the places I've found that to be most evident is in what Marcus Borg calls the three macro stories of the Bible. In his book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, Borg identifies not one, not two, but three primary stories that span the whole of the Old and New Testaments. And each one has a completely different understanding of the purpose of religion. Each one addresses one major aspect of the human condition and offers a straightforward solution. The problem is, conventional Christianity has emphasized just one of those stories, to the exclusion of the others. And to make it worse, most Christians then literalize that story and warp it beyond recognition. What are these stories? Well, one is bondage and liberation. Think slavery in Egypt. The second is exile and return. Think Israel's captivity in and return from Babylon. And the third is sin and forgiveness. Think blood sacrifice in the temple. And here's that problem I've mentioned. As an institution, the church has gotten stuck. It's become fixated on just one of these stories, sin and forgiveness. The primary message of most churches is that we are horrible, terrible sinners, and we need to bathe in the blood of Jesus or pay indulgences or whatever to buy off God and compel God to love us again. Central to the church's business plan is, number one, convince people they're guilty, and then offer the guilty the good news that the church is the only legitimate redemption center for people who feel guilty. It's pretty slick. But what if you don't buy it? What if guilt isn't your problem? Maybe you feel trapped and stifled. You don't need forgiveness. What you need is to be set free. Maybe you feel cast off and alienated from what's important in your life. You don't need to be set free. What you need is a way back to start over. Well, you're in luck. The other two macro stories, bondage and liberation, and exile and return, are what you need. Over the course of a lifetime, we all find ourselves in different situations and in need of different solutions. Take, for instance, the life experience of people like me and our guide to being people of the way, Kurt Struckmeyer. Both of us have lived by any measure the comfortable lives of college-educated, professional, white, male Christian Americans of German ancestry. Our forebears came to America from Germany, Alsace, and Switzerland in the 18th and 19th centuries, settled on the East Coast and in the Midwest, and worked as farmers, laborers, and in my case, musicians for generations. We were then raised by solidly middle-class parents. Not rich, but definitely not poor either. And here's the rub. Most of you within the sound of my voice are like Kurt and me. We were born into opportunity we took for granted, privilege we did not earn, and an ignorance about the reality of the world for people who don't look like us. Kurt, for instance, assumed that all veterans of the Second World War, like his father, were granted access to the GI Bill of Rights, with its grants for college tuition, low-interest mortgage and small business loans, job training, hiring privileges, and unemployment benefits. But that, in fact, is not true. Over a million African Americans returned from World War II to brutal racism, discrimination, and the intentional, systemic denial of GI Bill benefits. Kurt and I suspect many of you, have profited from a white, male, Christian power structure that paved the way for much of the success in life that we take for granted. In our educational opportunities, job opportunities, even in the neighborhoods we were allowed to live in. But not all Americans were given the same opportunities. I was an adult before I learned that until the 1960s, official City of Phoenix policies outright banned Black residents from living in or even visiting parts of Phoenix north of Van Buren. Look, the metaphor of the American dream is that of climbing an economic ladder. As we climb, we naturally tend to keep our eyes on the rung above us, towards those who have more than we do. And because a few are incredibly wealthy, we tend to think of ourselves as poorer than we really are. If we'd only turn around and see the people back down the ladder, we'd realize how incredibly well off we are. And as today's words of wisdom say, we ought not just be out for ourselves. If you see some brother or sister in need and have the means to do something about it, but turn a cold shoulder and do nothing, what happens to God's love? It disappears. And you made it disappear. My dear children, let's not talk about love. Let's practice real love. This is the only way we'll know we're truly living, living in God's reality. So, how different would our lives be? How different would the church look if, as followers of Jesus, we got over our obsession with the self-centered sin and forgiveness narrative and were intentional about looking at life from a different point of view, from the margins, from the borders, and the periphery of society, and then responding with what the author of 1 John calls practical love? I think it would look a lot like one of our other biblical macro stories, and it's called liberation theology. As a social and political movement within the church, liberation theology, as we understand it today, really took hold, surprise, in the 1960s, and is the conscious effort to understand the gospel through the lived experience of oppressed people. Inspired by Vatican II's call to update the church's teaching, Latin American bishops saw that their social situation demanded that the church go beyond preaching and sacraments to acknowledge that more was needed than the forgiveness of sins, and called for Christians to be involved in the practical transformation of society. And it was right there in the Bible all along. Look at the prophets, Amos and Micah, or the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, and oh my gosh, get a load of Mary's diatribe in Luke's Magnificat. God has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts, has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. God has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. Faced with brutal poverty, systemic injustice, and political violence, they declared that the church, like God and the witness of the Bible, should exercise what they called a preferential treatment for the poor. And this doesn't mean pitting one group against another, but calls us to strengthen the whole community by assisting those who are most vulnerable. What resulted was the rise of a grassroots movement of what were called base communities. They studied the Bible and applied its lessons to their particular situation. They worked to meet the community's material and practical needs for food, water, electricity, and basic sanitation. Often organized by local priests or lay leaders, they organized rural peasants into self-reliant communities that soon began demanding change and, worse, making change through unions, protest, and voting. And just like Jesus' early Christian movement of peasants, they inevitably became a threat to their repressive governments, the military power structure, and the wealthy elites, who were presented with a major PR problem. You see, the powerful and elite had counted on the church keeping the poor in their place, convincing them that they were terrible sinners in need of forgiveness, and that their poverty and suffering was part of God's plan. Remember the Deuteronomic code? You get what you deserve, and deserve what you get. And now, the church is betraying that status quo and legitimizing another story? Liberation from bondage? And it was not only biblical, but Jesus was at the center as liberator, standing firmly on the side of the poorest of the poor and defending the rights of the oppressed. Followers of Jesus were called to work toward a just society, bring about social and political change, and align themselves with the needs of the excluded in reorganizing social, governmental, and economic structures so the oppressed were not merely cared for, but transformed into vital and thriving human beings. Radical. Now, while the liberation theology of South America dealt primarily with the relations between rich and poor, its influence went on to be felt in the U.S. in the form of Black liberation theology, feminist liberation theology, and various gender liberation theologies. Each in their own way has acknowledged the macro story of bondage and liberation and helped us see that the gospel is not just about sin and forgiveness, it's about justice and taking the life experience of those who are not like us seriously. Whether you realize it or not, the fountains in our witness as a reconciling, open, and affirming church has been an important part of both LGBTQ+ and queer liberation theology, which is one of the reasons we confuse so many people who perceive us as a threat. People who are stuck in believing the Bible's only message is that of sin and forgiveness simply cannot wrap their heads around the idea that Jesus' primary message was about liberation from bondage, here and now, not just obsessing about earning a seat in heaven. They clutch their pearls and declare, if you believe any of this liberation theology stuff, that the next thing you know, you'll be believing that Jesus cared about the oppressed, the weak, and raising up the socially marginalized. What can you say, right? Kelly Krause, the author of Queer Theology, Reclaiming Christianity for the LGBTQ Community, writes, Jesus was concerned with love above all else. He loved the outcasts of his day, and he loved them fiercely. That's why, as people of the way, we are most likely to be living into Jesus' expectations when we follow lawyer and activist Bryan Stevenson's advice. We've got to find ways to get closer to the poor, the neglected, the abused, the excluded, the marginalized, because it's in proximity to these communities that we hear things that we will not otherwise hear. We will see things that we will not otherwise see. Friends, how you understand a life of faith depends on how you read the Bible. And sadly, conventional Christians have limited themselves to just one of the three major stories in that Bible. All three have something important to tell us about the human condition. All three reveal different aspects of the divine and how we should live. and the macro story of bondage and liberation compels us toward a preference for the poor and oppressed. Being present to their needs means mutual enrichment. And if we discover unhealthy social structures that prevent them from becoming vital, whole human beings, then we are obliged, as followers of Jesus, to work to change those systems. And it won't be easy. It took us over 50 years to change the exclusive, harmful policies of our own denomination. But we did it, from bondage to liberation. Last year, Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia, who also happens to be the Baptist preacher currently filling Martin Luther King Jr.'s pulpit at Ebenezer Baptist Church, introduced the GI Bill Restoration Act to Congress. In recognition of the fact that so many African-American World War II vets were denied what every white World War II vet received, this bill would give the families of these vets access to VA home loan guarantees, provide educational assistance benefits, and establish a study to fix other inequities 80 years late, but nevertheless honoring these earned benefits for these vets' families. Congressman Seth Moulton said, "We can never fully repay those American heroes, but we can fix this going forward for their families. While our generation didn't commit this wrong, we should be committed to making it right." Now, if you're thinking this kind of reparation is not appropriate, then in the name of Jesus, I say, shame on you. If these vets were white, would you feel the same way? It is time for people who consider themselves followers of Jesus to accept that it's not just about the sin-free you lounging on your comfy heavenly cloud. It's about liberation from bondage. It's about doing justice. It's about loving kindness. It's about doing what's right. Jesus wants us to pay attention to the people at the bottom, people on the fringes, people who don't look, act, or think like we do. And who knows? When we pay attention, we just might have our perspective changed. Maybe even enough to help shape the world into something more like what Jesus had in mind in the first place. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.